Hi.
Hello.
I told you to get the sniffles out of the way before we began.
Listen, I'm wearing a new fragrance, and I'm not used to it.
You just bought it an hour ago.
And then I was all sweaty, so I put it on, and I didn't want to smell bad in your home.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Pentacles and Tentacles. This is Chrissy.
And this is Shelby.
Hi.
This is the podcast where we do whatever we want at this point.
Yeah, I think we've given up hopes and dreams of...
The last episode we released was the Chicken Commission.
Which, if you listen to that, I'm sorry. But I am the supreme chonk.
I listened to it and it was just like, burp city. And then, what is the flavor?
I only listened to, like, the first, like, 10 minutes of it, and I was like, I can't do this, I'm embarrassed.
And halfway through, it was just, like, the coke hit, and it was burp city for me.
I mean, it was a lot of food.
Yeah.
I was not in a good mental space after that.
No.
So, hello.
Hello. That's car.
Whee! Sorry, there's vehicles around me.
There's a yard sale. Many a yard sale.
A yard sard. Have you ever seen the people that mess up yard sale signs? It's like yard sard or Yale sale. Oh,
no. What if someone was selling Yale? Would you buy it?
Yale?
Yeah.
Like a college?
Yes.
Yeah.
How much? I mean,
$5.
I'll give you a nickel and some advice. It's not good advice.
But it's unwarranted.
Listen.
And it's worth a nickel.
It'll help somewhere.
I mean, I'm not dumb, so I feel like it would be okay.
Yeah. It's a pretty place.
Sometimes I'm dumb.
I'd buy Yale.
I've never been there.
It's alright.
Have you been there?
I feel like I was when I was little. Like, we were just in the area. And they're like, let's look at it. I've seen Dartmouth, which is in Vermont or New Hampshire. I wanted somewhere to go there. I'm not smart enough for there.
No. I love you, but no.
No.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Hello?
Again?
I'm trying to think of how we shall begin.
I had a mental breakdown at work yesterday.
Which, to be fair, I've been having this same mental breakdown for months now, and then it finally hit Shelby, and I had zero sympathy. I was like, yep.
Yep. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is not a good friend, but I also am dead inside to work-related things, because I hate our job.
Yeah. Oh, do you hear
snap,
that?
Crackle, pop. Your I'm neck.
Just fucking died.
So our job sucks.
It does. Everyone was so rude yesterday.
Yeah.
But it was so like, up until that point, everyone was horrible. So I think it just, like, compounded a lot of things.
I know.
But then afterwards, I had 5 people in a row like, oh my god, you're so nice. And I was like, why didn't no one listen to that one?
Even then, we still have gotten points taken off because I got point. We get our calls. We work in a call center, basically.
Mm-hmm.
A glorified call center, and we get our calls, like, graded.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a call, I got points taken off because I breathed, and she thought I yawned.
Oh my god.
She was like, you need to apologize for yawning, and I was like, I literally took a breath, because I was, like, reading something to them, and I was like, okay. And she was like, you need to apologize for yawning.
Oh my god.
So now every time I yawn, I'm like, oh my god, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to yawn.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, why are you apologizing? Like, because I have to.
Yeah.
And they're like, why? Is it because I have to?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's unprofessional.
Because it's nervous when I was gonna be mean. I'd like to say her name, but whatever.
We're not gonna.
No.
I don't know. It's just really frustrating, especially now, because life sucks.
So, like, they... So for a while, we were scheduling for a certain region of the state. And then, right before the pandemic hit, they gave us the whole state.
Well, they gave us part of, they gave us extra parts of the state. And then, after COVID happened, they're like, actually, you're going to do the whole state now.
In the middle of a pandemic. And here's all these other things you have to check on. And you have to enter in someone's insurance without looking at a card. And half the time, listen, if I ask you for your ID number on your insurance card, Just find a number. Don't say it's not there. I know it's there. Don't be stupid. Find me some numbers. Be like, is this it? I'd rather have someone ask me, is this it? Rather than, it's not there.
Or, you know, you could just say, I don't have my insurance card.
That's fine. I would gladly accept that. Be like, all right, I can't do that then.
Be like, it's fine. Just bring it to your appointment.
Yep.
Lovely. Sorry, that was our work vent session.
Work rant.
Hopefully no one from work listens to this. Hi, Ashley.
Besides Ashley. Ashley's fine.
Ashley knows we hate it.
Yeah.
So this episode, we are talking about an asylum, and then Shelby's going to talk about some dirty things that happened at an asylum. Just one of them.
Not that kind of dirty.
Oh, no. Well, it's still shady.
Shady things.
Because I think what we're going to do now is...
Not themes,
but talk about related topics.
Yeah.
To keep it...
cohesive.
Yes. Instead of two separate topics.
Yeah.
So, I'm going to go first because that makes sense to our topic.
Yeesh.
I'm going to talk about the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum. I got this information from Wikipedia, All That's Interesting, and the Lore Podcast. So, located in Weston, West Virginia, it operated from 1864 to 1994. Mm-hmm. It was called a Kirkbride Psychiatric Hospital, and the name was changed to Weston State Hospital in 1913, but then it was changed back to the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum once it was opened as a tourist attraction, because I assume that just means it just brought more. Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum sounds way more dark and creepy as a tourist attraction.
Do they do, you know, like how State Penitentiary does, like, the haunted stuff? Do they do it
so,
too?
So, I don't think they do, no, not like the Eastern State does.
Yeah.
They do, like, tours and, like, ghost tours and stuff, but, like, Eastern State is, like, a haunted house type thing.
I'd like to go there.
So, it was designed in a Gothic Revival in Tudor-style architecture by Richard Snowden Andrews. The construction...
Richard Snowden.
I know. It took place from... The construction happened from 1858 to 1881, and it was originally designed to only hold 250 people.
Okay.
Keep that number in mind. 250 people.
Mm-hmm.
So, the Kirkbride was the style of this asylum. Mm-hmm. And it was because of Thomas Story Kirkbride, who was a then superintendent of the Pennsylvania Hospital for the Insane, and he consulted on the construction of this hospital and many hospitals around the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Under this thing called the Kirkbride Plan. And the designs of these buildings were mainly based on his beliefs and theories of healing the mentally ill versus containing them.
Okay.
He was, like, really into, like, the environment and exposure to light and natural air. Like, he just was, like, everything needs to be in the open, every big windows, lots of windows. And the way that it was set up was, like, in this batwing style, so it wasn't enclosed.
Okay.
So, like, everything had lots of windows, lots mm-hmm. of air circulation. And this also allowed a lot of freedom in his plan, so he believed that patients should be able to, like, kind of roam freely as much as possible because they'll behave better and feel better if they have some sort of control over their lives.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And this was also, I believe her name was Dorothy Dix, was also a woman that helped him. She was, like, a really big advocate for the mentally ill and really into, like, healing them versus containing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the Kirkbride Plan. There is a list on Wikipedia of all the different Kirkbride hospitals, and they are all really cool looking.
Hmm.
And there's a lot in Pennsylvania.
Really?
Not a lot, but, like,
there's a decent amount.
There's one in Danville.
Oh.
That's still a hospital, actually. A mental hospital.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So construction stopped on the asylum during the outbreak of the Civil War in 1861. Mm-hmm. The hospital was renamed to the West Virginia Hospital for the Insane. And this happened after West Virginia became basically admitted to being a United States state.
Okay.
During the Civil War, when it's like, I guess we'll be a state now.
Okay.
The first patients were admitted in October of 1864, but construction continued until 1881, and they had separate rooms for black people, which was pretty normal. although shitty, but...
Major womp womp.
Yeah. And those were completed in 1873.
Okay.
The hospital was designed to be self-sufficient, which was a huge thing for a lot of places, actually. So, like, they had its own farm, a greenhouse. Yeah. It had, like, a dairy, a waterworks, and a cemetery on the grounds.
That's something I noticed with, like, when I looked at other, like, asylums. Like, they're like, oh, we're self-sufficient.
Even prisons, then, yeah. too. Like, the prison here used to be a completely self-sufficient prison. And it used to provide for other prisons.
Wow.
Yeah, and then things started happening. Mm-hmm. But the grounds, guess how big the grounds were? How many acres?
Oh, God. I'm gonna, like, severely underguess or overguess. Guess. It's an acre.
Just guess.
50.
No. 666.
Ah! I told you I was gonna severely...
666!
Oh!
Be smarter. But that was on Wikipedia then again, so who knows if that's actually true, but it's spooky.
Quite.
And then in 1913, it was changed to the Weston State Hospital without the insane part of it. And again, originally designed to hold 250 patients, by 1880 it was holding 717. And basically, the original design was each person got their own room, they were comfortable. Clearly, once they held 717 patients, this was not happening. So
we went from 250
to 7. Just, it gets worse.
Oh, no.
So this was not happening, and it became already overcrowded. And then in 1938, it held 1,661 patients.
No.
And then in 1949, over 1,800.
God.
And then its peak was in the 1950s. It held 2,600 patients.
No!
Yeah, so the farm and dairy were unable to meet the requirements due to the increased population. And basically, patients started starving.
Oh, God.
And began to suffer from malnutrition, which in turn increased their mental, like, mental health issues.
Yes.
Because you're hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a lot of stuff's gonna happen if you're malnutritioned.
Fun fact, one of the first steps of starting a cult is make everyone turn immediately to a vegetarian or vegan because the loss of protein makes you stupid.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. That was a very not technical term, but that's, like, the short and sweet version.
Basically, it probably makes you more susceptible because you're missing a lot
yeah,
of...
Yeah, you're, like, very, like, loopy and tired and very easily swayed and stuff. But, yeah, first step to joining a cult, make everyone a vegan or vegetarian.
I love meat.
Mm-hmm. And we will never join a cult.
Purely because I love meat. So, a report in 1938 found that the hospital was primarily housing epileptics, alcoholics, drug addicts, and the educable mental defectives is how they phrased it. And then another report in 1949 found that there was poor sanitation, insufficient furniture, lighting, and heating in the majority of the complex. Mm-hmm. But one wing was rebuilt using the Works Progress Administration Fund after a fire happened in that wing that was set by a patient.
Oh.
And, but that wing was completely luxurious in comparison to the rest of the hospital.
Oh, okay.
Due to the lack of furniture and lack of heat, patients were sleeping on the freezing floors. And there were, like, sometimes five or six people to a room when it was just meant for one person.
It makes me think of, you ever see, like, those drawings of Bedlam?
No.
I'll show you after, but that's what it makes me think of. It's very sad.
Okay. The Weston State Hospital was home of the West Virginia Lobotomy Project in the 1950s, and this was an effort made by the state and by Walter Freeman to use lobotomies to reduce the amount of patients in asylums.
Mm-hmm.
Freeman was a famous surgeon and lobotomy advocate who performed more than 4,000 lobotomies, and he left some patients completely healthy and normal, and then some had lasting cognitive damage, and then also resulted in a lot of deaths.
Mm-hmm.
By the 1980s, the hospital reduced population due to changes in the treatment of mental illnesses. A lot of things were becoming more outpatient than inpatient.
Mm-hmm.
And then patients who were not able to be controlled were locked in cages.
Oh my God.
And which was a very common thing.
I know, but still.
Yeah. It was very common. In 1986, the governor of West Virginia named Arch Moore, he announced that a new facility was going to be built and the Weston State Hospital would be converted to a prison. The William R. Sharp Jr. Hospital was built, and then in turn, Weston Hospital just closed.
Okay.
Instead of being converted to a prison. It was auctioned by the Department of Health and Human Resources in 2007, but before this, it was vacant up until then. So from 1994 to 2007, there were a couple things that were held there, but most of it was just local tours, events, like some fair, like craft fairs and that kind of stuff. It, to me, is a huge ground, so. Yeah. And then in 1994, all four floors were damaged by the city and county police officers playing paintball. Three of these officers were fired for doing this.
Sirs. No.
Yeah. So, Joe Jordan, who was an HVAC guy that worked on the premises before, he was the high bidder of this auction for the hospital, and he paid $1.5 million for the building.
Wow.
And then the main building of the asylum now holds several rooms that serve as a museum. It holds paintings, poems, and drawings made by the patients during their art therapy programs. And there's a room dedicated to the different types of medical treatment and restraints that were used during. So, like, the tubs and, like, lobotomy equipment, all that kind of stuff, and straitjackets. There's a, I guess, a room of, like, the nursing uniforms and that kind of stuff. And they hold tours. There's, like, a short tour, a long tour, and then there's, like, a ghost hunting tour. It's been in, I believe Ghost Adventures actually did an episode here. I didn't watch it because I didn't need Bagel Bites.
Bagel Bites.
I didn't need Zach in my life for this.
Sometimes it's necessary and sometimes it's not.
So it is haunted, apparently, because of these ghost tours. And, I mean, I would assume most asylums are haunted because of the amount of terrible stuff that goes on there.
There's a lot of negative energy happening in them parts.
So, Maddie, my roommate from college and one of my very best friends, she went there for a tour with her mom and I think her aunt.
Cool.
And I'm going to read what she's told me.
Nice.
I went to this insane asylum with my mom, aunt, and uncle. Walking through the building was more fascinating than scary. Basically, the tour guide explain the conditions that the patients were objected to until we reached Ward F on the fourth floor. I was overcome with a queasy, lightheaded feeling. I wanted to get out of there as soon as possible, but I also didn't want anyone to think I was being a baby, so I didn't say anything. Luckily, we soon headed back downstairs to end the tour. I didn't think much of it until a few days later when my mom and I were discussing the tour. She mentioned that she started to feel really sick on Ward F on the fourth floor, and which was the same place I did. Ward F was where the most violent male patients were held, and where some say the most paranormal activity holds.
Damn.
Yeah. And Maddie did tell me this once it happened. Like, we talked about it before. And I don't know. I bet there's a lot of spooky things there, and I want to go and see it.
I after going on the ghost tour at Eastern State, I want to do more. They're, like, even if you don't see or hear or feel anything, they're still very, very fascinating.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I liked it. All right. You ready?
Yeah.
All right, so my section of this little tour is going to be on lobotomies. There are some medical things that I do find fascinating. This is kind of one of them, but it also just makes me mad.
They still do them.
Very, very rarely. A lot of countries have them banned.
We'll have to talk about electroshock therapy, because that's still very used.
Yes, yes it is. So, they were invented in 1935 by Egas Moniz? So, first name is E-G-A-S, last name M-O-N-I-Z.
Egas Moniz.
Moniz. A Portuguese neurologist.
I don't know then if it's Portuguese, so who knows.
He believed patients with obsessive behavior were suffering from fixed circuits in the brain.
Okay.
Which, I feel like that means, like, just things are just stagnant, or, like, it's not moving.
See, to me, that fixed circuits, to me, reminds me of, like, when I'm in therapy, I go to therapy, like, ruminating thoughts. So, like, that's, like, part of anxiety is, like, you have ruminating thoughts and a circuit just is, because they call it a circuit.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what that reminds me of.
Yeah. So what he invented was called a leucotomy. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to pronounce it. This is where you actually drilled holes into the patient's skull, either in the sides or on the top. And then a leucotome, pretty much a sharp stick, is then inserted into the brain and swept side to side to cut the connection between the frontal lobes and the rest of the brain.
Ow.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the brain has no nerve, so...
No. But the drilling into the skull is a big ow.
Well, I mean, you don't have any nerves once...
swirling it around in there. He won a Nobel Prize for this in 1949.
Did it work?
I mean,
it had to have worked somewhat.
I mean, it made people not violent and not obsessive because you can't think anymore.
Were they not, like, functioning, though?
So, I'll get to there. The quote is, it turned lunatics into idiots.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the quote they use. This was being used for mental health improvement. Hold on. So this started being used for mental health improvement by Gottlieb Burkhardt, who is a Swiss neurologist.
Mm-hmm.
He operated on 6 patients with schizophrenia doing this. He had a 50% success rate.
That's a terrible success rate. Yes.
And that just means the patients calmed down. Like, they could still be having hallucinations.
They just weren't as manic about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or they were just comatose. Staring. Which is common. He was harshly criticized by colleagues, as he should be. And now we get into Walter Freeman in 1936. He was a psychiatrist, and another neurosurgeon who they don't mention performed the first U.S. prefrontal lobotomy on a Kansas housewife.
Okay.
Yeah. He believed that an overload of emotions led to mental illness, and that cutting certain nerves in the brain could eliminate excess emotion and stabilize a personality.
So they just wanted you to be flat.
Yes.
They wanted you to have no emotion. Mm.
So pretty much what I'm gathering and from a couple stories, it was people who were a little bit more emotional or a little bit more hyper than normal. They didn't like that.
So this, I'm assuming, like when they said women were suffering from hysteria,
mm-hmm.
this would have been something.
Yes.
Okay.
That you would at least consider or do. Or force your wife to do.
I would have. Thank God I didn't live that. Because could you imagine during the Great Depression of my life, they would have put me in a lobot. They would have strapped me down, electroshock. Oh my God, I would have been.
Yeah, it's not good. But this is where he created the 10-minute ice pick lobotomy.
10 minute.
It takes 10 minutes, and it's literally with an ice pick. He found it in his kitchen, and that's what he used.
Okay.
So this was first done January 17th, 1946 in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
This is where a ice pick is hammered through the eye socket into the brain and wiggled around, often leaving patients in a vegetative state.
So how is that considered a success rate?
Because they're not screaming. Oh, they're quiet. That's better. You're just shutting them up.
Okay.
Let that sink in. Everyone.
It's sinking and it's going through my butt now.
Yeah. He was known to perform 25 a day. This is where it turned lunatics into idiots, that quote.
I'm doing the math on 10-minute lobotomies. He did 25 a day.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And
that's a short work day.
And he would do them in front of audiences. And he liked to sometimes take 2 ice picks into both eyes at the same time. Just for shits and giggles.
So he was a sadist.
He's an asshole.
Or which one's a
masochist?
Sadist is if you like it yourself.
We went through this the last time and I still don't remember. Either way, he's a dick butt.
He liked inflicting and he's mm-hmm. a psychopath.
Yes. So this is a quote for someone who watched a lobotomy. As those who watched the procedure describe it, a patient would be rendered unconscious by electroshock. Freeman would then take a sharp ice pick-like instrument, it was actually an ice pick, insert it above the patient's eyeball through the orbit of the eye into the frontal lobe of the brain, moving the instrument back and forth, and then he would do the same thing on the other side of the face.
Should I tell a story about my mom?
Yes.
So my mom had to get her deviated septum fixed, and my dad took her to the hospital, as you do,
mm-hmm.
and on the way there, my dad told my mom she was getting a lobotomy.
No!
And my mom was like, no! And he, like, my dad is very deadpan.
Very dry sense of humor.
Like me.
Yes.
And I think my mom believed him.
Oh, no!
Anyway, it didn't fix her deviated septum. She still has it. So it was not a successful story.
Yeah.
But my mom went in thinking she was getting a lobotomy.
And that's so sad.
And probably felt like it.
Probably. That's what they say when you have to get the COVID test. It feels like they're touching your brain because they go so deep up in your nose.
Oh, just give me that lobotomy. Just...
If I ever have to get COVID tested, I'm going to tell them. Be like, is this my lobotomy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So this was a time before antipsychotics and medications, and asylums were very overcrowded, as we have come to know.
Yes.
So, like...
This is a huge problem.
Yes. I get why it happened. What year was this? 30s and 40s.
Okay, because this is right when that started becoming really overcrowded, because everyone was like, everyone is nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever watched American Horror Story Asylum?
Yes.
One of the best seasons.
Mm-hmm.
But it reminds me of that.
Yeah.
Where they had the doctor. I wonder if that's who that doctor was.
Probably. I remember watching a movie in my, one of my psych classes about him, and it, like, went through, like, the rise and how pretty much he loved the fame of doing all these lobotomies.
Well, I'm sure.
And then when people started, like, coming in and saying, you should do medication, like, these lobotomies are really bad.
Was lithium the first?
I don't know. We should look into that.
We should do a thing on that.
Just on medications. That'd be fun.
Anti-psych.
Yes.
Let's talk about my good old friend Lexapro.
Prozac, what?
It didn't do a damn thing for me.
I like it.
I mean, it made me not suicidal, so there.
It did some.
Yeah.
But I remember this movie, and other doctors would come and be like, you really should stop doing these. Like, they're bad. And he was, like, super adamant about, like, no, like, drugs aren't going to work. You can only carve into the brain, blah, 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 blah. It's just because he was so good at it, and he didn't want to stop.
I don't think he was good at it.
Good at it.
I think he was into it. I think he was too into it to the point where he was too proud.
Mm-hmm.
Could you imagine being a doctor who, like, I assume the Hippocratic Oath still happened then.
It should have.
I don't know when the Hippocratic Oath started.
Yeah.
But leaving a patient in a vegetative state is not doing no harm.
Exactly. And
that is leaving them unable to live their lives.
And it is really, really sad because, like, while researching all of this, by the way, I got my research from psychcentral.com and BBC. But seeing pictures of people, and it was like a before and after.
Yeah, they look dead inside.
They dead in the eyes, but a lot of them are just smiling. And they're just like,
well, I saw this video. I'm sure it was just like a cartoon, like not a cartoon, but like a reenactment of like this husband who goes and gets his wife a lobotomy because she was too hysterical after something happened, and he comes home and she's like the perfect housewife because all she does is obsessively clean and cook and just has no emotion.
Like, here's one, a before and after.
That's sad.
I'll find some pictures and I'll put them on the gram. And then there's a couple others. Actually, one of the Kennedys got one.
Yeah,
Rosemary?
That was one that was really sick. It was the one who had a lot of mental illnesses.
Sierra is convinced that's why they are cursed, which, like, fair.
She went through a lot of treatment. Like, she had electroshock therapy and a lot of that, didn't she?
But a lot of people just said it's just because she was a wild child. And that's just her personality.
Well, that's a lot of people, like, in America. Like, I know this isn't truth.
Yeah.
But in American Horror Story, they talk about the one woman who's, like, a sex addict. Mm-hmm. They called her a sex addict because she was, like, happy and, like, getting
free love and stuff.
She was getting around, and they gave her a lobotomy, and then they electroshock therapy, hydrotherapy, where they, like, boil you to death, basically. Yeah. Like,
the things we did for mental illness are...
And it's still so widely unknown.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating to me.
Because when I was in college, it was... In the time span of humans, it was a recent discovery that your brain and your body are actually connected. Like, your mental health is going to affect your physical health. For a while, no one thought those two things would ever coexist.
That's so bizarre, because that just makes sense
to me. Yes, it does. And, like, now you're like, how would you not think that? Like...
Well, because you've seen, like... Okay.
Yeah.
My rant is over.
Okay. We will continue. In 1967, Freeman did his last lobotomy after being banned from operating.
Okay.
The reason he was banned is because he performed a third lobotomy on the same woman. This woman had three lobotomies, and she died of a brain hemorrhage. No one needs one lobotomy. No one needs three.
That's sad.
Yes. In the U.S. alone, there were 40 to 50,000 lobotomies performed.
What is it?
40,000 to 50,000 in the U.S. alone.
Wow.
Yes. Majority happening between 1940 and 1950.
And he did 4,000 of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge number for yeah. one.
Yes. If it's 40,000, that's 10%.
We're bad at math. We weren't math majors.
It's fine.
Yes.
But in the 1950s, a bunch of other countries had lobotomies banned. That included Germany, Japan, the Soviet Union.
They had it banned.
The Soviet Union said it was contrary to the principles of humanity.
Wow. Yeah. That
makes me sad.
That the Soviet Union...
That makes me sad.
Okay. In Germany.
In Germany and Japan.
Okay.
Yeah. The UK was also huge for lobotomies. They did more than 1,000 per year when they were in their heyday. But that's because the alternative was a lot worse. Their mental institutions were also very, very bad. One doctor said, when I visited mental hospitals, you saw straitjackets, padded cells. It was very apparent that some of these patients were, I'm sorry to say, subjected to physical violence. And this was from a retired neurosurgeon named Jason Bryce. They had specific lobotomy centers across the UK. One was in Dundee, North Wales, and Bristol. And the most prolific lobotomist was Sir Wiley McKissick, based in Atkinson Morley Hospital in Wimbledon. Apparently, he was one of the great men of medicine in the 20th century. He believes his one of his proteges, Terry Gold, believes that McKissick performed around 3,000 lobotomies. And his was only 5 minutes.
Wow, speedy.
So he even had a shorter work day. So he would travel across South England at weekends performing extra the leucotomies, so the one where you have to drill the holes in smaller hospitals. And he would travel all the time, anytime, to go do this. He's like UK Freeman. Meh. So there was one operation would have some dramatic benefits for some patients. So one woman would apparently got one because she was terrified of fire. Okay, full fire phobia. But after she finished, she went...
Became a pyromaniac!
She went and bought herself fish and chips with grossly hot oil in it.
Like
they were really hot fish and chips.
Just fresh out of the oil?
Fresh out of the fryer.
I don't know why, but I thought even, like, spicy. And I was like... that's a different kind of fire of your asshole.
Yes.
Ooh, I could go for some Nashville hot chicken right now.
But, so McKissick actually turned later against lobotomies, okay. I'm pretty sure. He had increasing doubts about them, especially with patients for schizophrenia. There's a psychiatrist named Dr. John Pippard who followed up with a bunch of McKissick's patients. He found that around a third were better off. A third were no completely change. The same, and a third were bad. He later turned against the practice. He says, I got increasingly conservative about it because I don't think any of us were ever really happy about putting in a brain needle and stirring the works. Not a nice thought. I want you to talk to Freeman, sir, and apparently he was very happy to do this.
That just reminds me of, like, I don't know. I'm upset.
Yeah. Patients that he talked to after, like, 30 to 40 years that were chronic schizophrenics were often the ones that were the most apathetic, slow, and knocked off. I guess just, like...
Yeah, me. I know what he means. I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah. There is...
Like a shell of themselves, yes. Basically.
There's a Dr. Marsh, who's now one of
Britain's... Walmart brand.
Yes. Kmart, even.
We'll go with Walmart.
Yeah. There's a doctor, Dr. Marsh, who's one of Britain's most eminent neurosurgeons, says the operation was just bad science. It reflected very bad medicine, bad science, because it was clear the patients who were subjected to this procedure were never followed up with properly.
See, like, I can get the idea behind it. Because, like, separating a part of a brain that's malfunctioning from the rest of the brain makes sense to me. But the way they went about it, does not make sense to me.
Like, I understand, like, at a point where you don't have medication and you're doing this, but you should really follow up with the patient after and see what the effects are. That is good science. But, like, so they would do this. If you saw a patient after the operation, they'd seem fine. They'd walk and talk and thank the doctor. The fact that they were totally ruined as a social human being didn't matter.
That's so sad.
That's incredibly sad. But,
like, there were just, like, husbands that had their wives subjected to this because they're, like, mm-hmm. they're too emotional and they're too needy and mm-hmm. they want me to do things. Mm-hmm. And then it just made their wives basically puppets.
Mm-hmm. So, I got two stories mm-hmm. of personal lobotomies. There is a British housewife named Eileen Davy. She had really bad depression after the birth of her second son. This was in 1948. They tried conventional treatment at the time. Her husband, Sid, signed the consent forms. Okay. Not her. And she said, I got the impression that it was... Or he said, I got the impression it was no more serious than having a tooth extracted.
So they made it seem like it was no big deal.
Yeah, it was nothing. Okay. Even though we're sticking a needle...
In your brain.
Yeah.
A pick in your brain.
A sharp stick. Someone stuck a stick in your brain and swirled it around. The reality was very different. She was irreversibly damaged. Eileen became apathetic and listless. She said, I've cracked, haven't I, as she put it. Several years later, she was told that the first operation had failed, and she agreed to a second round of psychosurgery. This is Sid's quote. I still felt that these were very eminent gentlemen, and if we're confident would be a success, it would be a success. They did it, and it was a disaster. Instead of curing her, she became more apathetic and had severe incontinence problems.
Hmm.
Yeah. And the second one, which I remember this, I think there's like a story or a book on it somewhere. Howard Dully, he was 12 years old.
Oh my god.
This is the one Freeman did. And he was interviewed in 2006, and he was 56. If you saw me, you'd never know I had a lobotomy. The only thing you'd notice is I'm very tall and weigh about 350 pounds, but I've always felt different, wondered if something's missing from my soul. I have no memory of the operation, and never had the courage to ask my family about it. The reason for his lobotomy? His stepmother. His stepmother said Dully was defiant, daydreamed, and even objected going to bed. He was 12.
So a normal 12-year-old?
A normal 12-year-old. And she took him to many doctors who said nothing was wrong with Dully and he was a normal boy, but Freeman agreed to it.
Because he was a psychopath.
Exactly.
I'm upset.
Yep. And that's the note I'm leaving you on.
That's really, like...
That one made me very, very, very mad. And I remember seeing... Because at the end of the movie that I saw in my abnormal psych class, it was his lobotomy. Because the stepmom brings in this little boy.
That's so sad.
Mm-hmm. And when I first think of lobotomy, I always think of Shutter Island at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, does he know? Does he not know? Is he just doing... But... And that's, like, kind of like, ooh, Hollywood. But then, like, you read these and you're like, that is just so sad. And the fact that they didn't follow up with him until many, many years later, 30, 40, 50 years later, is...
How you doing?
Is bad science and terrible medicine.
Yes.
As someone who studied science in college, that's bad.
Even when you start a new psych medication, you have to go back in 6 weeks anyway to make sure you're doing okay.
Yeah. Now we know.
And we don't even know because people don't even know how SSRIs work mm-hmm. other than, like, they don't know why it works.
My arch nemesis in college was a psych major and didn't understand how medications worked and when people said they had a chemical imbalance. And I wanted to slap her.
What do you mean? Like, she didn't understand that, like, you're like missing something?
Like, someone posted on Facebook, like, I'm diagnosed with depression, like, I have a chemical imbalance, I'm taking these medications to help regulate these hormones and chemicals in my brain that give me the depressions.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, how do you know that you have a chemical imbalance?
Because I want to die.
Because, like, that's what depression is, and if I'm taking a chemical that raises the level of the chemical that should be in my brain, I was clearly not in balance.
Like...
And she just couldn't grasp that concept.
I mean, like, they still don't, like, it fascinates me that they make these medications that they don't really know how they work other than they work.
I firmly believe that doctors are human mechanics.
That makes sense.
And they're like, you know, it's not always going to be 100% effective. We're going to try.
Like, I mean, like SSRIs, we know they increase the amount of serotonin.
Mm-hmm.
But how they do that is kind of like not 100% known.
Yeah, because every time you try to map out a brain,
it's, every brain is different.
Every brain is wired very differently.
So it's just like fascinating to me that like, I just want to know what the first antidepressant was. I bet it was lithium.
Probably. Or another opioid.
Well, lithium is just like a natural
chemical.
Like a natural chemical.
Hold on, let's do a quick Google. What was the first... I don't want to read this.
Antipsychotic?
Psychotic drug. Chlorpromazine.
What is the...
Clozapine?
Clozapine.
Yeah. I mean, I feel... And that's for schizophrenia, which I feel like is the... Like, when you... Like, when most people think of mental illness, like, the big baddie, quote-unquote, is schizophrenia. I feel like that's the one where people can't deal with it the best. Like, other people can't deal with someone with schizophrenia as well as they could deal with someone with anxiety or depression.
Yeah, I mean, where, like, also you could, schizophrenia...
Like, oh, she's just nervous. She's just sad.
Schizophrenia is also a lot more life-altering.
And very life-threatening.
Yes. Depending on the type of schizophrenia you have.
Visual hallucinations, your brain is not doing great. Auditory's a little better, but like visual, because your eyes are a direct connection to your brain is essentially dying.
Good times.
Good times.
All right.
Well, thanks. That was sad.
This is a shorter episode, but that's okay. Yeah. Because you had to listen to the Chicken Commission.
Chicken Commission!
Chris, which there's going to be other episodes after that, I think.
We have one other recorded.
I don't remember.
I forget what it is, though.
We're bad at this.
People will literally send me stuff on Twitter, like, in quote, and be like, when did I say that? Where? I remember nothing.
All right.
Okay, well.
Bye.
Hey.
Okay, wait, Shelby has to say something.
Be safe. Have fun. Make some new friends. I hope you learn something new. Don't get a lobotomy. And come back here.
Bye.
Bye.
I can't find the button.